Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Thank you very much for your generous welcome and indeed for the invitation to be here for this Veritas Forum. I've taken part in one or two other similar events elsewhere in the United States, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening. Though I've visited Atlanta on several occasions, for some reason that I don't quite understand, I've never made it onto the campus of Emory before, so I'm delighted to be here and to see what a beautiful place it is. So thank you on all of those counts, and for your kind hospitality, those who've organized this evening. The question that I've been asked to address, and by the way, I'm at the tail end, I hope, of a rather nasty cold, and so my voice is not all that it should be. I hope you can hear me both in this room and in the overflows, and there may not be much we can do about it if you can't, actually, but I hope you can. The question I've been asked to address is, why does Jesus' resurrection matter, considering its relevance for today? Now, as you've heard, I wrote a book on the resurrection some years ago, published under the title The Resurrection of the Son of God, and it's the longest book that I've ever written. I thought it was going to be quite a short book, maybe 200 pages or so, and then I taught a course at Harvard about 9 years ago on the resurrection, and I did 25 lectures on it, and after each lecture I came out thinking, I should really have made that into two lectures or possibly three, because the material just grew and there was so much written that I wanted to engage with. So the book grew and grew and grew. And when it was published, I sent it, as I send everything that I write, to my parents. My father is now 88. He never read any theology until I started to write it, and now, bless him, he's read quite a lot. And he doesn't have a huge amount else to do with his time. He's reasonably fit. But when the book arrived, he sat down and just started right in. And 3 days later, I got a phone call. 3 days is very symbolic, of course, for this whole thing. 3 days later, I got a phone call saying, I finished it. And I said, you've what? I said, Dad, it's 750 pages. You can't. He said, I just started right in, and apart from eating and sleeping, that's all I've done. And he said, and this is the point, he said, I tell you what, he said, I really started to enjoy it after about page 600. Which I thought was one of the most interesting semi-compliments that I've ever had. He likes to keep me in my place, obviously. But I said, my father used to work in the lumber business, in the what we call the timber industry. And I said, Dad, the book is like a tree. It's got a root system. And unless you have a very deep, strong, wide root system, the trunk isn't going to stand up and the tree isn't going to bear any fruit. And he said, yeah, I sort of figured that, but I always preferred the upper branches myself. And because the argument of that book, which what I'm saying this evening and in my new book, Surprise by Hope, is based on, is that in order to understand what happened on the first Easter day, you really have to get your head and your heart and your mind back into the world of the first century and see things with their eyes and hear the words that they would hear with their ears. And in order to do that, there's a lot of preconceptions that we have to shed, which we, many of us in the Western world, have grown up with. For instance, preconceptions about heaven. I was coming through Atlanta Airport first thing this morning, and I noticed on the bookstore 3 or 4 books about heaven by somebody who claims to have been there. He died, in inverted commas, in a car smash, and after being technically dead for some while, was resuscitated and retells in these books the experience he had of bliss, of beauty, of music, etc. Now, I don't knock that. There's quite a burgeoning literature of such experiences, although there are other people who've had similar moments and they report nothing of the kind, and it's not clear what we should deduce from that. But most people in the Western world have an image of the Christian hope as going to heaven when you die. And if you ask them what heaven is like, they may well talk, and the covers of these books reflected this, about a place in the sky with fluffy clouds and people, angels, souls sitting around playing harps. Guess what? Now, that's very common, very widespread. Last time I was in America, I did what I often do and visited one of your great cultural icons. That is to say, I went and got a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And on the cup of my venti latte or whatever it was, there was this neat little quasi-philosophical reflection. I think they like doing these things. Apparently they have a website full of them. I intended to bring the cup with me on this trip as kind of exhibit A, but in my flurry of packing a week ago, I left it behind. So I looked it up on the web, and here it is. It's a little piece by a reporter on the Los Angeles Times, Joel Stein, or Stein, I don't know how he pronounces it, and it goes like this. Heaven is totally overrated. It seems boring. Clouds, listening to people play the harp. It should be somewhere you can't wait to go, like a luxury hotel. Maybe blue skies and soft music were enough to keep people in line in the 17th century, but heaven has to step it up a bit. They're basically getting by because they only have to be better than hell. Fascinating. But actually, you know, he's right in terms of the traditional Western Christian perception of heaven as a rather boring place. And he's by no means the first to say that. As he points out on the website, Mark Twain said something similar, and many other people have done so as well. But the good news is that the Christian gospel is not primarily about going to heaven when you die. That comes as a shock to a great many people who have assumed all their lives that that is the name of the game. And I'm here to tell you that heaven is important, but it's not the end of the world. That is to say, there is another life to come out beyond that, a life called resurrection. We'll get to that in a minute. But there is, as I say, enormous confusion about death, life after death, and all the language and the fuss that goes with that. 10 years ago in England, I woke up one morning and listened to the radio to hear the news that somebody had been fired from their job because of holding heretical beliefs about the afterlife. And I confess that my first thought was that they had caught up with one of those liberal bishops at last. But no, this was 10 years ago. But no, it wasn't. It was a football coach. Astonishing, you might think. A man called Glenn Hoddle, who was the coach of the England football team at the time, which is a very high-profile job in England, as you might imagine, had given voice to his conviction that people who suffer from disabilities at birth are being punished for sins that they committed in a former life. Now, there are some varieties of some species of Hinduism where that is a common belief. There are many other varieties of other forms of religion which don't hold that. But anyway, the disability groups and other interest groups got onto the press. The press got onto Glenn Hoddle, and he was forced to resign, which is extraordinary. I mean, why should somebody's wacky beliefs about the afterlife affect whether they're a good football coach? But no, he was a public figure. He shouldn't say such wicked things. Now, the really interesting thing to me about all this was that several commentators in the press discussing it referred to Hoddle as, quote-unquote, a born-again Christian, which seems to mean, in England at least, somebody who takes their religion a bit too seriously. Because the confusion about the afterlife is so great that anyone who believes in reincarnation, in something happening afterwards, oh, well, they must be one of those religious people. They must be one of those Christian people. Well, if he's taking it that seriously, he must be a born-again Christian. The fact that he was however many times born, maybe multiply born if you're a Hindu, The fact that he was giving voice to something which is nowhere in the Christian tradition at all didn't seem to register. There is widespread, massive confusion, as there is about the nature and shape of the Christian faith and the Christian hope and the Christian life, which is characterized in the New Testament primarily by love. And so, following St. Paul, I want to talk to you this evening about faith and hope and love. And first, the resurrection as the linchpin of Christian faith. The resurrection is the linch. It isn't, in other words, something you can bolt on to the outside. Yes, I'm basically a Christian, but I'll take it or leave it as regards the resurrection. You know, that's like saying, yes, I want to drive the car, but I'll take it or leave it as regards the steering wheel. Well, sorry, no, you're not going to get very far if that's what you do. You see, in the first century AD, and in the roughly 50 years either side of it, so making roughly a 200-year span with Jesus in the middle, we know of 10 or a dozen other Jewish messianic or quasi-messianic movements. We know, because of the historian Josephus, who was a contemporary, a little after the time of Jesus, but contemporary with many of those movements. We know what they did. We know that people talked about the kingdom of God. We know that they went about promising their followers signs of salvation and deliverance. And we know that in pretty well every other case of which we have evidence, those movements came to an end with the violent death of the founder or the key figure. And if, when that happened, you wanted to continue the movement, then you had a choice, quite clear in first century Judaism. If your would-be Messiah gets executed by the authorities or otherwise done away with, you have a choice. Either give up the movement, go and live a quiet life somewhere, or find yourself a new Messiah. Fascinatingly, for an ancient historian, the Jewish groups that had followed Jesus of Nazareth didn't do either of those things. They continued the movement, and they said, astonishingly, that the recently crucified Jesus was the Messiah, and therefore, by the way, was the Lord of the world. That's a whole other business. Why did this one group suddenly mutate into this fascinating new movement that was taking forward the kingdom of God project as they had understood Jesus to be living it and doing it, and saying that it was actually going ahead with him still in charge? The answer that they all give was that he'd been raised from the dead. He'd been resurrected. Now, let's be quite clear what the word resurrection meant in the first century. The Greek word anastasis, resurrection, and other words like it, in whether it's in Aramaic or Latin or whatever, were never a fancy way of saying life after death. They were always a way of saying life after death. Now, that seems to be very clear, but I've discovered with experience that not everyone gets it first time. Actually, I thought of calling the book, Surprised by Hope, Life After Death. And after trying it out on various friends, I got so many puzzled looks and people sending emails back assuming this was a misprint, you know, that I'd just put in one too many life afters in there somewhere. That it clearly does need some explaining. If you believe in resurrection, you believe that when the person dies, they are dead for a period, whether it's a few days or a few thousand years or whatever, and then at some future date, that person will be raised to a new bodily life. Resurrection was never a way of saying, in other words, John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave while his soul goes marching on. They had ways of saying that, and resurrection was not one of those ways. You can check this out. I've written it up. Other people have written it up. It shouldn't actually be controversial. Geza Vemesh, leading agnostic Jewish scholar in Oxford, has recently published a book on the resurrection with a very unsatisfying conclusion, but he makes it quite clear at the beginning that in first century Judaism, that is what resurrection meant, a newly embodied life after a period of being dead. And now let's get something else clear historically. People have sometimes said, I've actually been involved in public debates where people have said this, that it is only we now, with 200 years of modern scientific historiography, who know that dead people don't rise. And indeed, when the Jesus Seminar was debating 10 years ago the resurrection of Jesus, when they went public with their findings, according to which Jesus didn't rise from the dead, they actually took to the press conference a young woman who worked at the local morgue so that she could bear witness, in case anyone was in any doubt, that normally when people died, they sort of stayed dead. Now, I find this totally extraordinary. Homer knew that dead people stay dead. Aeschylus says that dead people stay dead. Pliny says that there is no such thing as... this is common knowledge. And what's more, it was common knowledge to first century Jews and to first century Christians. In other words, they didn't think that this was just an odd miracle which might occur from time to time and it just sort of happened to Jesus. They knew perfectly well that in the ordinary course of events this didn't happen. Didn't take 17th or 18th or 19th century science to tell us this obvious fact. Rather, the Jews of the time, some of them, not all of them, the Pharisees, who were among the leading theoreticians, as it were, the early rabbis in Judaism, they believed in resurrection because they believed in a good creator God who was going to sort the world out once and for all, eventually. If you believe in a good creation and in a God who's going to put the world right finally, then one of the likely places you'll end up is saying he will have to raise people from the dead. We'll come back to why that is so in a minute. Nor, please note, and again, maybe I don't need to make this point, but people do get very confused. To say Jesus was raised from the dead is precisely not to say that he died and went to heaven. The ascension of Jesus is a different topic. Again, I might come back to that, but I touch on it more in the book. There may not be time to say absolutely everything in the next 40 minutes or so, but I'll try. What happened on Easter Day, according to the stories, and they are some of the strangest stories ever written, so don't imagine that I think they're just, oh yeah, that happened kind of stories. These are just mind-blowing stories. But what they say is that having been thoroughly physically dead, Jesus was physically alive again, though not resuscitated back into the same sort of life that he'd had, but somehow, strangely, in ways for which they don't really seem to have had very good language, gone through death and out the other side into a new sort of embodied life, what in the big book I've called transphysicality, still certainly physical in our terms, but somehow seeming to have different properties. Very strange. But this is the linchpin of Christian faith, because Christian faith is not the belief that Jesus is a great moral example or a great guru, or that through him and in him we glimpse some sort of divinity somewhere, but it doesn't really matter what happened to him afterwards. Rather, Christian faith, at its most authentic in the early documents in the second century and again throughout history, is the belief that in and through Jesus of Nazareth, the Creator God achieved what he'd set out to achieve all along, which was to deal with the problem of evil and particularly the problem of death itself, and to launch a project which we can call new creation. And that isn't something that has to wait. It's something, according to the New Testament, that happened. It was launched in Jesus. Our Western world has so resented the claim that something really did happen at the resurrection of Jesus, because our Western world is built on the belief that world history reached its climax in the 18th century in Europe and North America, when we had this thing called the Enlightenment. And if you tell the story of history that way, it's rather difficult to tell it the other way. That's why it's wanted to rule resurrection out of court. But the Christian claim really is that world history did turn its crucial corner, even though it may take the eyes of faith sometimes to see it, when God launched his project of new creation. If you take the resurrection away, obviously all this collapses. Jesus becomes another failed first century would-be Messiah. You may still say he's one of the finest moral teachers ever to walk the earth, but that wouldn't generate this odd thing called Christianity. But the question, of course, is, can an intelligent person with an open mind believe this amazing, ridiculous, outrageous claim? When the apostles went round the ancient world announcing to people that Jesus was raised from the dead, that must just have been like somebody telling a joke in a foreign language. You can see the guy thinks it's funny, but you can't figure out why. You know, I had an experience like that the time before last when I was in Atlanta. I was here for a conference the Society of Biblical Literature held in one of the big downtown hotels, and it happened to coincide with the final of the World Cup in rugby. Now, I suspect that not very many people in Atlanta took a huge amount of interest in the final of the Rugby World Cup. But actually, it was England playing Australia, and for me and many others, this was very big. And because of the time lag, etc., I had to creep down from my room in the hotel at 6 a.m., and I phoned my daughter back home, who I knew would be watching it because she's a keen sports fan, and she told me the great news that at the very last minute, with the final kick of the game, England had won the World Cup. And of course, when I put the phone down, I wanted to go around the hotel lobby and tell, you know, the sleepy people on the desk and so on that England have won the cup. And I thought, I don't think they'll get it. I don't think they'll understand the significance of this moment. And you need to realize that when the early Christians went round talking about Jesus and the resurrection, that was precisely the effect. Read the Acts of the Apostles and see, when Paul said it in Athens, they laughed at him. Some people said, that's so extraordinary, we may need to hear you again about that. But others said, oh, phooey, you know, we know that stuff doesn't occur. Why should we then believe it? Well, in the big book, I have argued that when you look at the early Christian movement, and not only the shape it took, but the beliefs and practices they adopted, and when you set that within the context of first century religious history, you are forced, as a historian, to say, why would this movement have taken this shape, have believed these things about Jesus, have believed these things about their own future hope? Because nobody believed what they believed before. Even within Judaism, there were several modifications of the Jewish expectation which the early Christians introduced. And if you ask the early Christians why all this happened, they would say, of course, because Jesus was raised from the dead. And so we have to say, well, wait a minute, why did they think this happened? And so we go back to the stories in the Gospels, which, as I said, are very, very strange stories, and they have the quality of breathless narrative, as though somebody has just seen something so extraordinary they're struggling to get it out and tell you about it. And they may get some of the details different from one another between Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, but they're all focusing on something extraordinary and amazing that's just happened. And those narratives that we have, many scholars have said, oh, they were made up towards the end of the first century by people who just wanted to validate the faith that they'd come to on other grounds. But there are several reasons for thinking that that can't be so. The first one, and I'm sorry about this for political correct reasons, the first one is that you would not have invented stories with women as the primary witnesses. In the ancient world, women were not considered valid witnesses in a court of law. But there they are, front and center in all those stories. One of the other ones is the strange portrait of Jesus himself. He appears as a man among men. He eats, he breaks bread, he does various things, invites people to touch him, and yet he comes and goes through locked doors. What is this about? He appears and disappears. There is no precedent and there is no prophecy in Scripture which would explain this in terms of somebody making up stories to fulfill some wish fulfillment fantasy. And there are other reasons as well why I believe and have argued in detail that those stories are very, very early. And they push us back, do those stories, to the empty tomb and to the appearances of Jesus as bedrock history. If there had just been an empty tomb, they would have said, somebody robbed the grave. That happened in the ancient world quite a bit, especially if it was somebody famous. If there had just been appearances, they'd have said, we just saw a ghost. It seemed as though he was real, but he's gone again. Oh, well, it must be, you know, one of those strange dreams, fantasies, visions that people have. Ancient literature is full of such things. But a disappeared body in an empty tomb on the one hand, plus appearances on the other, convinced them that it really was him and that he really was alive again with this transphysicality. This body, which was the same body because the mark of the nails where he was crucified was still there, but it was somehow different. And the only explanation for these two bits of historical bedrock, the only explanation that makes any sense at all, is that it actually happened. Now, you can argue the toss about that. When I published my big book, I sent it to my former philosophy tutor in Oxford, who is a lifelong atheist and has remained a good friend. And he read it through and he said, you made a very convincing case. But at the last minute, he said, I simply choose to believe that there must have been some other explanation, even though I cannot imagine what that could have been. And I say, fine, okay. I am not indulging in a sort of intellectual arm-twisting as though to say, you must believe this or I'll beat you over the head with my rationalistic arguments until you do. No. Because I fully recognize that the resurrection is not simply a very odd event within the old world the way it is. It is a very odd event within the old world the way it is. It is also, and at the same time, the prototypical and launching pad event of the new world that God is making. And at that point, this isn't a matter of history over there and faith over there. It's a matter of the two rushing together in a way which our Western worldview has not wanted to allow for, but which the stories force us towards. And the image that I've often used, and here we are on a university campus, is of a university or college being given by some rich old member a fantastic painting, a huge, great work of art, which is just stunning and valuable beyond the dreams of avarice, and just such a beautiful, fantastic thing that you must display it somewhere important and central. But you walk all around the university campus and you go into room after room and hall after hall, and there's nowhere that is really ripe to take this great piece. And eventually you decide this is so important and valuable, we're actually going to do some demolition and rebuilding. We're going to knock down some of our present structures, and we're going to redesign the very center of our college or our campus around this great work of art. And then, pushing the illustration beyond the bounds of reason, but you'll see the point, as you do the reconstruction, you discover that all the best features of the campus the way it was are enhanced, and all the worst features of the campus the way it was are actually somehow got around or eliminated. In other words, the resurrection does not fit comfortably into either the ancient pagan worldview or even the ancient Jewish worldview, because no Jew had expected exactly this sort of thing to happen, one person being raised in the middle of history. Nor does it fit, of course, into the modern secular or rationalist or materialist worldview. But if you are prepared to hold your worldviews where you can see them for once, instead of just looking through them, and say, what would happen if we put this resurrection thing in the middle? Then you'll find that all the best features of other worldviews regroup themselves in a new configuration around this extraordinary central feature. And once you've got that in place, then all sorts of other things come into place as well. This is how the resurrection matters. It is the linchpin of Christian faith. Now, more briefly, secondly, the resurrection is the launching pad of Christian hope. Christian hope is not hope for pie in the sky when you die. Christian hope cannot be reduced simply to this business of going to heaven. As I said before, it's about a two-stage post-mortem reality. There are passages in the New Testament which speak of that intermediate state. Jesus says to one of the thieves dying beside him on the day he was crucified, "Today you will be with me in paradise." Now note the today, because today was Good Friday. And as we heard before, Jesus was not raised from the dead until the Sunday. Paradise is not a final, ultimate resting place. It is a word for a garden. Imagine the most lovely garden you've ever seen, with a stream of water flowing through and trees just coming out into blossom and birds singing. And imagine when you're tired and weary, being able to go there and rest and be refreshed. That's the image of paradise. Until you are ready for the new world that God is going to make. Because that's at the very center of the Christian picture. And let me say about the future hope. Everything that the New Testament says about the future, and certainly everything I'm saying about the future, is basically a set of signposts pointing into a fog. We can't actually see the reality of what we're talking about in the future, but these are signposts which we believe to be true because the resurrection of Jesus is the launching pad of this hope. And the hope for the future is not just for us, it is for the world. St. Paul says that the creation itself, which is at present, as we know, groaning in travail, is going one day to be liberated from its slavery to decay, to share the freedom of the glory of God's children. In other words, God is going to do for the entire cosmos at the end what he did for Jesus at Easter. That is the full dimension of Christian hope. And if you believe in creation, very interesting, and I wouldn't presume to speak about your American debates about creationism, but in my country where those debates have washed over, it's fascinating that some of the people who are most fixated, if I can put it like that, on a creationist position do not seem to believe in the goodness of creation when it comes to new creation, but seem content to say that, well, okay, the world was made by God, but he's sooner or later going to throw it in the trash and do something else. Because that dualism, which has infected so much Western Christianity, does no justice whatever, and I mean justice, to the goodness of creation and the goodness of God the Creator. Rather, in the New Testament, we have images like that one I've just quoted about birth. The creation groaning in travail, waiting for the new world to be born from the womb of the old. Or images like marriage, the final coming together of heaven and earth, the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven to earth. Images like those in Isaiah, where you get the wolf and the lamb lying down together, and a king who does justice at last. Justice is a good word, a strong word in the Bible, and it's about God putting things right at last. And so we have in the Bible this picture of a new world in which heaven and earth come together at last, no longer separate. A world which is in continuity as well as discontinuity with our present world. That is a fascinating promise. And in the middle of that, and all because of the resurrection of Jesus, we have the appearing of Jesus himself. When you get that big picture of the new world, with heaven and earth coming together, then and only then can you understand this strange doctrine called the Second Coming. In my experience coming to and fro to America now over many years, I find that some Americans talk of nothing else than the Second Coming, and others are so fed up with their particular theories that they hardly mention it at all, or are actually sometimes rather embarrassed about it. The good news is that if you understand cosmology in the way that I've just indicated, the Second Coming suddenly makes a lot of sense. Because heaven and earth are not geographically miles apart. You know, some years ago I wrote an article in the periodical Bible Review, an American journal, deconstructing the fundamentalist doctrine of the rapture. And among the letters that were sent to the editor after that issue, you know, people cancelling their subscriptions and that sort of thing, and there were one or two, there was one which said, how does Mr. Wright think he's going to get to heaven if he doesn't get raptured? And I said to some friends, are there really people in this wonderful planet of ours who think that God lives some few miles upstairs in the sky somewhere? You know, like when the Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin went around the world in his Sputnik, he came back and he said, I've disproved God because I've been out there and had a look and I didn't see him anywhere. And some Christian theologians were really rather relieved, actually, because God is not the sort of being who would be an object within our cosmos. heaven and earth are the interlocking and overlapping spheres of God's good creation. That's how they're meant to be. We perceive that momentarily, sometimes through an experience of beauty or love or great justice or whatever it may be. Sometimes in worship, sometimes in prayer, sometimes not. We are aware of other dimensions. And the good news is that one day the thin veil that separates heaven and earth will be drawn aside. And the Jesus, who Christians believe is personally present, though hidden, in the heavenly dimension at the moment, will be the central figure of that new world. That's why some of the New Testament writers don't talk about his coming, they talk about his appearing. He is present but hidden and will one day appear. And when he does, it will be in order to set everything right. All those promises about God doing justice at last will come true through him. And all because of the resurrection. That's what Paul said as the climax of his speech in Athens, before the skeptical philosophers of his day, who were really not up for this stuff at all. He said, God has fixed a day on which he will judge the world, in other words, call the whole world to account and put it right. And he will do it through a man whom he's appointed, and of this he's given assurance to all people by raising him from the dead. That is the center of the Christian message. And then, of course, it goes on that in that new world, those who are in Christ will be given new bodies. The resurrection of the body. It's a totally strange doctrine to many devout Christians who really do think that the name of the game is to get their soul into a disembodied place called heaven. And when they say, I believe in the resurrection of the body, in the creed, they think, but don't really mean that. We actually know it's the immortality of the soul. Well, that's just being fooled by the incipient Platonism of much Western culture. But if you have that vision of creation and that vision of justice, then resurrection, as I said, is where you get. And the point is this. The physicality that we are promised in the future is an immortal physicality. Immortality doesn't mean disembodiment. That's a Platonic lie. It is, Paul says, an immortal physicality. It will go through death and out the other side. It's not a resuscitation. It's a different body, but in continuity with the present one. And I sometimes put it like this. If you're with somebody who you know and love, who's then very sick, you come out of the hospital and you say, poor old so-and-so, he's just a shadow of his former self. You know, the Christian good news is this. If you are in Christ and indwelt by the Spirit, you are just a shadow of your future self. There is a real you which is more like you than you could ever imagine, if you see what I mean. Only somehow fuller and richer and stronger. And all the things about you which God has done in you enhanced and ennobled. And all the things which are decaying and need to die done away with. And if that isn't good news, I don't know what is. This is what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5 when he talks about the new body which we are waiting to put on top of the present one. That's a metaphor, of course, in terms of clothing, but he says that's some way of expressing what it'll be like. There are hymns which celebrate this. Oh, how glorious and resplendent, fragile body shalt thou be when endued with so much vigor, full of health and strong and free. Wonderful picture. Now, many Christians imagine that if there is to be a resurrection, you somehow get fast-tracked straight there immediately after you die, that time sort of collapses and you go on this conveyor belt, shoomph, and then you get to that ultimate future straight away. I don't actually believe that for this reason, that Paul in 1 Corinthians says that Christ is the first fruits, and then at his coming, his royal appearing, those who belong to Christ will be raised. And the point about new creation is that it's not throwing the old world away and making a totally new one. It's making a new one out of the old one, like Jesus' new body, as it were, being the transformation of his old one. That has not happened yet. Therefore, Jesus is the only one yet who has been raised. But what will this new body be? How will it be composed? What will it be made of? does it have to be in continuity with the present one so that if somebody gets burnt, either by accident or in cremation, there's nothing for God to do this with? No, that's not a problem. Partly it's not a problem because God is the creator and God can do what God wants to do. But it's more subtle than that. Tertullian, at the end of the second century, was once asked, supposing a cannibal eats a Christian, and supposing the cannibal then converts and becomes a Christian, at the resurrection, who is going to get which bits? And Tertullian basically said, oh, don't ask silly questions. Yeah. But his near-contemporary Origen had a better answer than that. Because, you may be surprised to know, but scientists at that stage already knew that human bodies are in a constant state of flux. It isn't just that fingernails and hair fall out or drop off or whatever. It's that our entire molecular kit is in a process of transition. So that roughly every 7 years, I'm speaking in the presence of a medical expert here, but I'm assured this is true, roughly every 7 years, you become a totally different person, gradually, not sort of suddenly all at once, but so that I am not the same person in any way physically who was around 10 years ago. Now, that's not a problem. C.S. Lewis, picking up this argument in his book Miracles, says, we are to that extent like the curve in a waterfall. There is continuity of form, but discontinuity of matter. Obviously, it's much slower in our case than in a waterfall, but you see the point. And in other words, it's not a big deal to get the same actual molecules back again. We share them around. They go around in a variety of ways throughout creation. What you eat turns into you. Isn't that odd? And then gradually your body changes. Anyway, you see the point. God can do whatever God is going to do. He will give you a body in which you will be you. You will be more you than you could ever imagine. Uniquely, gloriously, God-reflectingly, you. And all this because of the resurrection of Jesus. What about in between? I sat with a widow my own age 2 weeks ago, whose husband, a priest in my diocese, had just dropped dead very suddenly. It was quite shocking. And we talked softly and slowly, with her two daughters there as well, about what we believed about where this good and fine man was now. And we talked about that picture of paradise with the thief, the blissful garden. And we talked about that passage in John's Gospel where Jesus says, in my Father's house are many dwelling places. And we noted that the word for dwelling places is not a word which means a place where you go to live forever and ever. It denotes a place where you go to rest and be refreshed, a wayside inn. My wife and I are staying tonight in a nice hotel where we are resting and being refreshed until it's time tomorrow morning to continue our journey. A wayside inn is a good image for the place that Jesus has prepared until the time comes for the resurrection. And Paul says, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. So there are ways in the New Testament of talking about where people are, how they are, who they are at the moment. Or if you prefer a modern metaphor, John Polkinghorne puts it like this. He says, God is going to download our software onto his hardware until the time when he gives us new hardware to run the software again for ourselves. Well, if that scratches where you itch, so be it. Not everyone likes it. But you see, the point is this. Salvation in the New Testament is not being rescued from this world of space, time, and matter into a disembodied state. That isn't salvation, that's called death. Salvation for the Christian is rescue from death itself, and that means resurrection, new creation. Resurrection, then, the linchpin of Christian faith, the launching pad of Christian hope, and thirdly, briefly, and finally, the solid foundation for Christian love. And by love here, I don't just mean warm feelings towards one another. Warm feelings towards one another are really quite important. Kindness and generosity are among the primary Christian virtues. But in the New Testament, the word love covers a lot more than that. It's something you do with your will. It's something you do with your imagination, where you have to train yourself to imagine what it would be like to treat this person, this group, this category of people, as if you really loved them, and then to discover that in doing them, you actually start to love them. Agape for the Christian in the New Testament is something you do with your wallet, with your bank balance, as much as with your feelings and emotions. And so I'm using love here, for the sake of this lecture, as a large word to encompass what the Christian is called to do because of the resurrection. Now you may say, surely, even if you disbelieve in the resurrection, you're still called to love people. Well, okay, fine. Better to love people without believing in the resurrection than not love people because you don't. But look at it like this. At the end of that great chapter on the resurrection in Paul's first letter to Corinth, chapter 15, you might expect him to say, because we have this wonderful hope set before us, lift up your eyes, look to this future which is waiting for you, because it's just a wonderful dream and one day it'll come true, and never mind anything else for the moment. He doesn't. He says the exact opposite. He says, therefore, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, because you know that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. Do you see the point? Because God is going to renew the creation and renew us with it, what you do in the present matters. You are not oiling the wheels of a machine that's about to drop off the edge of a cliff. You are not planting a bed of roses where the bulldozer is going to come tomorrow and sweep them all up in order to construct a new football stadium or something. You are actually doing things which, though we can't see how at the moment, will last into God's new world. New creation has already begun. The resurrection is the solid foundation for Christian love in the fullest sense in the present. Living as a Christian looks like this. You look back to what God achieved in Easter, and you are called in the power of God's Spirit to implement that in the present. You look on to what God is going to do in the future, and you are called in the power of the Spirit to anticipate that in the present. Living in the present, implementing Jesus' resurrection and anticipating new creation. And in my book, literally and metaphorically, this is called building for God's kingdom. What do I mean by that? Some older theologians used to talk about building the kingdom, which always sounded as though we could just roll up our sleeves, work hard, and we'd make the kingdom of God come by our own efforts. That technically in theology would be called a sort of social Pelagianism, I guess. Attempt to pull yourself up by your social or moral bootstraps. No, we don't build we build for the kingdom. What do I mean? Where I work, one of the places I work, is one of the most wonderful cathedrals ever constructed, Durham Cathedral in the north of England. And I imagine 1,000 years ago, the stonemasons in the yard, probably illiterate, and the foreman comes into the yard and says, I want you to carve this chunk of stone with this bit of pattern and in this shape and these dimensions. And the chap probably wouldn't understand it if you explained to him why you were asking him to do that. But he gets on and he does it. And then one day the master builder comes with the architect and the stones are hauled up by some primitive scaffolding and they're put into place. And there is that little stone, but it's hugely important because it's part of that much larger pattern that he'd never imagined and never seen. He's building for the cathedral. Let me tell you, when you go and work with drug addicts, with homeless people, when you go and teach Sunday school to kids, when you go and do whatever it is that God is calling you to do today, tomorrow, with your life, you are not building the kingdom. That would be arrogant and dangerous, actually. You are building for the kingdom. You may not, you will not understand the larger patterns within which your bit of the work is going to fall, but they are there and they matter. And in the book, I've explored two in particular. I'm not going to go into detail because my time is up and I'm already thinking of apologizing to the organizers for going on too long, but there we are. Love in action, beauty and justice. Art is love creating new worlds. Justice is love rolling up its sleeves to heal the old one. Get that? Art is love creating new worlds, anticipating, pointing forward, saying, yes, there is pain, yes, there is grief, yes, there is awfulness, but yes, there is also beauty, and we're waiting for that to be fulfilled. If you're an artist, a musician, a poet, a painter, a writer, a dancer, whatever, I believe that's what you're called to do. And justice is love rolling up its sleeves to heal the old one. And I guess we're all called to be involved with that in all sorts of ways. Because when the church is doing beauty, and when the church is doing justice, it creates a hermeneutical context within which it makes sense to say, Jesus of Nazareth was raised from the dead, and he is the Lord of the world. And if you're not doing that stuff, you're whistling in the dark. We are talking about a whole new world with the risen Jesus in the middle of it. And within that, of course, there is the personal, deeply personal call to love God, to love one another. In other words, to be a Christian is to be a little walking part of God's new creation here and now. That's what it means to be a Christian. To become part of God's new creation project, both in yourself and through what you're called to do. To become part of God's artwork, as Paul puts it in Ephesians 2. And to hear the call to help the work forward. Resurrection is the solid foundation for love, as well as the linchpin of faith and the launching pad for hope. Isaiah 11, if you want to go back and read that tonight, that is the goal, as far as I'm concerned, along with Revelation 21 and Romans 8 and a few other passages. The world that God will make, when the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. How do the waters cover the sea? The waters are the sea. God intends to flood the whole creation with his joy and his justice and his love and his wisdom. He's already begun that in the resurrection of Jesus. He calls us to become part of that project. That, my friends, is why the resurrection of Jesus matters. Thank you.
For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org.